This is The Takeaway. Thanks so much for listening. And you might say 50 years ago this month, the world dressed up in a terrifying costume in the days before Halloween. A battle between the two superpowers, the Soviet Union and the USA, seemed to give the entire planet a death wish back in 1962.
Good evening, my fellow citizens. This government, as promised, has maintained the closest surveillance of the Soviet military buildup on the island of Cuba. Within the past week, unmistakable evidence has established the fact that a series of offensive missile sites is now in preparation on that imprisoned island. The purpose of these bases can be none other than to provide a nuclear strike capability against the Western Hemisphere.
Nuclear missiles stationed in Cuba by the Soviet Union. John F. Kennedy there speaking to the nation in October of 1962. The 13 days of the so-called Cuban Missile Crisis is a neat bookend for historians. But the sheer tension of that nuclear confrontation transformed the Cold War. It resonated well beyond those 13 days. Author David Coleman's latest book, The 14th Day, JFK and the Aftermath of the Cuban Missile Crisis, says the actual threat to the world continued well after October 28th, the day we're told the crisis ended. David Coleman, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
So this was a big event that resonated throughout history, but in specific terms, the trigger was still armed after we were told the crisis was over, yes?
Yes, it was in many ways. There was the most crucial part of the threat, obviously, was the nuclear missiles that Kennedy was talking about in that speech that you just played. And what happened on the 13th day, on October 28th, 1962, was that Khrushchev said he would remove them. Now, the Soviets had said things before that were not true, directly to Kennedy and to others. And so there was very real fears within Kennedy and amongst Kennedy and his advisors that perhaps this was just part of some big trick. The second part is that it wasn't just about the nuclear missiles. There were also other nuclear forces in Cuba, including long-range bombers that could easily reach the United States and short-range nuclear missiles.
So you have access to secret White House tapes that begin to tell part of this story here. What does it say about Kennedy and the players? Because what you're describing here is this was an enormous gamble that Kennedy was taking.
It was a gamble, but it was a calculated risk. He was being very careful throughout the aftermath of the crisis because he didn't necessarily want to take Khrushchev directly at his word. He realized that that was politically untenable. So they had to put in place safety nets to make sure that things were happening. And one of those was that the military kept mobilizing. And it wasn't until November 16th, about 3 weeks later, that the Joint Chiefs of Staff were able to come in and tell Kennedy, look, we're finally fully mobilized. We're ready to invade if you tell us to do so. And they were still discussing whether or not there should be airstrikes against the bombers in Cuba and against some of the other forces in Cuba.
Talk about the quid pro quo here, because we're told, historians tell us, that there were some Turkish missiles that were already going to be decommissioned. Missiles, U.S. NATO missiles stationed in Turkey, nuclear missiles, Jupiter missiles, I believe they were called, that were supposed to be taken down as a kind of symbolic quid pro quo for Khrushchev. Did that figure as prominently as we were told?
It did figure prominently. How heavily it weighed on Khrushchev's calculations, we don't know. But you're quite right. There were Jupiter missiles in Turkey. They were technically owned by NATO. They were provided by the United States. And they were one part of the deal that was negotiated secretly at the end, and that was negotiated directly between Robert Kennedy and the Soviet ambassador Anatoly Dobrynin. And this part of the deal was kept secret for many years, or at least quieted up. How much they figured in Khrushchev's calculation isn't known, because they weren't that much of a threat to the Soviet Union relative to everything else that was around at the time. And they were older missiles, frankly. They weren't especially useful as far as strike missiles.
You know, we are told, and we're talking with David Coleman, who's the author of The 14th Day, JFK and the Aftermath of the Cuban Missile Crisis, thinking about that 50 years on. You know, we're told that both Kennedy and Khrushchev appeared to rise to the occasion in a kind of save the world moment. But do the White House tapes give you more of a sense that Kennedy was holding back the hawks in trying to prevent something from getting out of hand here?
He certainly was in many ways. He was being very careful, as he often was. Kennedy liked to keep his options open, and that's something that comes through very clearly on the tapes. But he was getting a lot of advice, particularly from military chiefs, that we need to take very forceful action here. General Curtis LeMay, the head of the Strategic Air Command, for example, was recommending some kind of military strike against Cuba, along with many of his colleagues. And Kennedy was pushing those back, but he wasn't rebuffing them completely. As I said, he liked to keep his options open, and he was keeping open the option that even though he was implementing the blockade, that might be followed up a few days later, if necessary, by military strikes. As it happened, Khrushchev backed down before that happened, but the option was still very much on the table.
Do we really know why Khrushchev backed down? Was he scared of something Kennedy said or did?
The best we can work out is that he simply saw what was happening. It was a no-win situation for him. There was no way out except for escalating even further, and that was just far too dangerous. Things had gotten out of hand. He'd been caught by surprise. But one of the actually 50 years later, there's no historical consensus as to why Khrushchev did it in the first place. Hmm. He gave a number of different answers, and historians have come up with a number of different theories, but we still don't know exactly why he started this whole episode in the first place.
Listening to those voices on those White House tapes and going back over this history, can you imagine leaders today in a nuclear crisis, say with Iran, that we're nearly in, it seems, in some ways, in very different circumstances? Can you see them behaving in the same way, having the same sort of sense of awe surrounding these kinds of weapons 50 years on?
I think there's probably 50 years on a little bit of the sense of awe has dissipated, but the danger is certainly still there. I think today the rate of decisions would have to be accelerated. Back in 1962, Kennedy had the luxury of finding out about these missiles on October 16th. But not going public until October 22nd. I'm not sure that could happen today. I think things would have to be accelerated far more quickly than that. As far as the different types of advice that you hear on the tapes, I think that really depends on the people. Because one of the things that the tapes brings out is that these decisions are very much made by people. These are not sort of decisions that are just put on paper, that are made automatically. That there are very real reasons and anxieties and insecurities and doubts that go behind these decisions.
David Coleman, author of The 14th Day, JFK and the Aftermath of the Cuban Missile Crisis. There's a conversation that you can actually be a fly on the wall to in reading that book. David Coleman, thanks so much.
My pleasure.